Ladies and gentlemen, Killer Keller Podcast, live and direct, Central London. Central as you need to be, could be, should be, or want to be, God damn it. Hope you're having a good morning. Big shout out to graffitikings.co.uk. Anyone's got the Kellervision app free download, you know the drill. You know, you get it for your street and art, you know, your street culture, sports, and all that business. App Store, iPhone, Android, you know the coup. Yo, we have in the house a good friend of mine, a regular on the Killer Keller podcast. Legendary, already in the making, from theatres to movies to God knows how many parters, Top Boy, Guy Ritchie, yeah. The Works, the man like Alessandro Babalola.
Guy, killer, yes. Pleasure to be back, my bro.
How's it going?
Bro, it's going well, man. You know what I mean? You know I've got a fondness for Kensal Rise, this era, you know, heritage and all that. So it's always good to pass through and come and check you, my guy.
Yes, yeah, my guy. Well, actually, it's funny. We're just talking, because you've been on before, hold tight, all the regulars at Anaku. Yeah. But there's some people that just have not clocked it. So we've got so much to play on, you know.
Yeah, honestly. And that last one we did was like, that was like, you know, I've seen a couple of the comments there and people are like, people are mind blown by that discussion, you know. Because I feel like it was like, what could that could be called, like, around the world and back in 80 topics. Do you know where I'm coming from? Like, literally, we just, like,
I don't know where we
encyclopedic discussion.
It was, wasn't it? And I think for a lot of people, that's baffling. People, it's no one's fault. I think it's just the way our brains are programmed.
Yeah, man.
Beatboxer, actor, that's all we got.
Yeah, and then between that, like,
we went
pages
in.
Of culture.
And
pages
we literally
of
went
culture
in.
And just topics, like.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, actually, that we did address. And what definitely occurred to me... Oh, hold on. Big shout out, Shemzy, inside the place.
Yeah, Shemzy. Don't
yes,
know.
Yes.
Check out the new single.
Yeah, the new single.
What's I can
new
feel sing? It.
I can feel it. If you're into your garage business,
yeah. Mr. Shemzy, I can feel it. Go and bump that on
cold,
YouTube.
Cold.
Spotify, iTunes, et cetera, et cetera.
There it is. And again, even heightening the fact and the point I was going to make, your association, your vocabulary, the words that you describe certain things, particularly in street culture land, you orbit around this stuff.
Yeah, man. You know, growing up in East London, and just being inspired by basically the culture that was pouring out around my area, East London, and just London in general, you know, like London as a city, you know, obviously I grew up in the 2000s, so much was born in the 2000s. Like, obviously, I know tons was born before that, but if we're talking from the 2000s, you had the tail end of the garage scene and then grime. Yeah. And then,
dubstep. You
know, that's it, man. Like, it was non-stop, wasn't it? So, like, growing up in Leighton, particularly, going to school in Leytonstone, where, you know, like, things like Lord of the Mites happen, you got all the... Bro, I told you, I don't think I said it last time, but I was barbershops in my area, DEE, Temper T. These are people you could just see at the barbershop, you know what I mean?
That's far too casual coming out of your mouth on a podcast,
bro. Like, you know what I'm saying? Jammer, you did Lord of the Mites, not too far from where my secondary school was, so... You know what I'm saying? The culture really... I'm lucky enough to say I surrounded it. And obviously, you've got to shout out my mum, who was constantly taking me to performing arts schools and stuff just to refine it, you get me? So that combination really did a lot for me.
Do you think the influence of, like, the area in which you grew up on? I mean, when we think about Top Boy, for those of you out of the UK, I'm almost certain you would have checked the film. It's like a 100-part or something.
It's very filmic, isn't it?
Cinematic.
Yeah, exactly. Incredibly cinematic, yeah.
Was there a lot of influence to you growing up that would have suggested, hey, you know what, I know exactly the kind of character I need to be?
Mate, let me tell you, I'm so glad you asked this. You see the character I play in Top Boy, right? If somebody had told me at 14 years old that I would play a character like that, though, I'll tell you out of your mind, but I wasn't thinking I'd be playing, but I didn't think.
Because it's the complete opposite of who you are.
Like, it's the opposite of who I am.
Yeah.
But think of who I was at 14. Just a little skinny, like, boy running around playing football, but obsessive Arsenal. Like, yeah, I like the music, but did a little dancing. But let's just say this, I'm not hard now, and I've never been hard. I've never been hard. Like, he's a hard man. I've never been me, but I've just been like a sort of, just a free guy my whole life. But whether I'm doing football, I was doing football matches in school, finishing that, and then asking my football coach to drop me to street dance. Do you know where I'm coming from? The guys on my football team are like, oh, well, Alex, you're going dancing, yeah? And I didn't realise they were taking a piss when they said it. I just thought they were asking me. I went, yeah, I am. Do you know those ones? Like, yeah. Like, only when I look back, when I was older, I think, fucking no, he did say that with a little bit of a grin, didn't he? Mm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like, you realise that someone was taking piss at you. But I was so, it was so normal to me. There was no, like, weirdness about
you
the fact
that. You were
immersed. Bro, there was no weirdness to me about the fact that I did several things. Bro, like, at one point, I mean, bro, I was going to perform in art school, bro, and we had to do ballet and tap there. And then I was playing football and on the school basketball team and doing long
Billy
jump.
Elliot shit. You know,
bro,
you...
literally, bro, like, I do feel like, yeah, man. Bro, I was proud of the stuff, you know, as well. Mm. You see, in school, I didn't hide it, you know. But everybody knew I did performing arts. People knew I was going to a performing arts school. It was a known fact that when I finished school, I went to performing arts or I was playing basketball. Bro, my life was, I don't know, bro, it's funny, like.
That's so sick.
I was just, you know, you see, like, Tupac, yeah, they say, oh, he... Well, they say he actually went to performing arts school for all of his early
Digital Underground and all that stuff, didn't he?
Bro, that's me. Mm. I was in performing arts school, bro, like every day after school, bro. Like, if I wasn't playing basketball, because that became my sport, my obsessive sport, I was football. Then when basketball hit, I played that nonstop because of height. I got tall and I was like, I'm going in. Bro, alongside that, as I said, I was doing ballet, tap, contemporary, musical theatre. You know, like, I mean, at one point I did street dance. Yeah, fam. One point I did street dance. Yeah, I went to a place called KCK in Leighton. You know what I mean? That's where I met my guy here, Shemzy, you get me? But, like, we used to, and that was, like, a place where you did street dance, music, poetry, rap. It was just, like, KCK meant Kids Culture Club. And basically, bro, a lot of the black kids of Waltham Forest would just go there. And it was a place to just get immersed in culture. So, as I said, it was, like, dance, rap, singing, poetry, acting, everything. But it was like very like black British energy, you get me? Whereas the performing arts school I went to wasn't like a black British thing. It was just a British thing. Mm-hmm. Black kids, white kids, Chinese kids, like Asian kids, everything. Taught by these two top level musical theatre performers, you get me? And they would, then we would, so then I was learning about musical theatre, bro. And ballet and tap and contemporary and jazz. And like, and doing Shakespeare monologues. You get me? Like, in fact, I was so immersed in that place, yeah, that I didn't even do GCSE in drama.
Because you were so in it.
That was it. I remember my mum saying, me and my mum chatting about it, and I was just like, you know what? I do so much performing arts. In fact, school is a place to get a breakthrough.
Don't need it.
Honestly, it was like that. I remember when my GCSE's coming up, yeah, my teacher was like, you're choosing drama. And he knew that I might not choose it. He was like, I mean, I would ask you if you're choosing drama, but you do, do you want to? And I said, I'm not, I chose PU.
Could you be wasting your time?
That's it. I saw just PE instead. I thought, no, I'm not going to do drama because I'm doing it. PE, boom, basketball, football.
Where does that tenacity come from, that drive of yours to make you want to transcend, to overachieve? Where do you get that drive from?
Bro, I think it's a couple of things. One of them is the fact that I'm Nigerian. You get me? Like, you see with Nigerians, yeah, obviously everybody knows there's a stereotype of, like, Nigerians being pushed to achieve academically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that same sort of... I had that same... I don't want to call it pressure. It wasn't pressure for me. It was encouragement. It was a push.
Right.
I didn't suffer from the pressure to achieve. I know some people who it hurt them.
And affects them emotionally?
Yeah.
Right.
It could have had emotional effects on me, but I can't name you any damaging consequences of the fact that my mum like encouraged me to do as much as I could. And essentially, my mum's whole thing was just like, try this, try that, try this. And she was always very encouraging. When I went to, when I was in school, for example, and we did the school plays, if I didn't get the part, bro, I would come home like moaning, upset. I don't even, like tantrums, bro, like being upset. In primary school, by the way, not secondary school. I was not throwing tantrums about
certainly not university.
You get me? Like, real talk. But in primary school, like, I remember being upset about not getting roles. And my mum would just be like, well, then it wasn't meant for you. The next one will be meant for you. Like, keep working.
That's
keep
such trying. A good
she
idea.
Just had that, bro. You get me? And then, like, and then my mum always used to say to me, trust me, like, this is what I mean about your mum manifesting and speaking greatness. My mum always would say to me, you're going to play so many lead parts. You're going to play parts. Don't you worry, son. And then literally, I got to performing arts school at about 14. And bro, lead roles nonstop. Then boom, university, lead roles. And then finish school, university. And then I'm in the industry and I'm doing projects that I never dreamt I'd be doing. Olivier Award and all that. So like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
come
my mum
on.
Just spoke that great. And I think, yeah, just that need to achieve.
Yeah.
It came from the pressure that most African parents put on their kids to achieve academically. my mom had an expectation of me academically, but she also just placed it upon anything I did. Yeah. And I took that voice in, and her voice of encouragement became my inner voice, which said, go, achieve, achieve, achieve. Obviously, not to ramble on you, but then I also watched her achieve a lot in my whole childhood as well.
What did your mum do?
Your mum's a teacher. She's in English, but she's got she's got like 4 graduation pictures in her house. And she's she just achieved a lot in her own life. She's had a shop. She's, you know, Greenwich University, this place, you know, college, lecturing English, working as this. Now, my mom is one of those people that she has an ambition and she fulfills it.
No ceilings.
And we have taken on that. Me and my brothers and I, we've definitely inherited that sort of tunnel vision. She's got the maddest tunnel vision ever, to the point whereby, bro, at points, I would say to you that, like, I have not been able to understand. I'm not going to name any names, but there's people that I've been close to, and I've been like, when I feel like, you know, maybe certain girls, you get me, that I've been close to, and I feel like they're not trying hard enough for what they want. And it's because I'm comparing it to my mum, who I saw just going in all the time. Also, obviously, my dad being a screenwriter, he did a lot of good things in his career. So I was seeing two parents that just achieved high. And it wasn't, you need to do this, you need to do that. It wasn't that. It was just like, I'm leading by example. And I followed their example. So yeah, I'll say it like that.
That takes a lot of pinpoint accuracy from a parent to find within the hodgepodge of like a child's mind what they're genuinely interested in and how to cultivate that.
It does. And I think my mum achieved it by just letting me do what I wanted, bro. Bro, let me tell you what. I did athletics.
Bollock thing.
I did athletics. I did football.
Sorry, it's a fly. Yeah, go on.
Athletics, football, swimming. Performing arts. Yeah. In my life, I went to about 3 different performing arts schools. My mum put me in one, that one's finished. Put me in the next one, that one. Then I found
just
the one that I love.
Kept it rolling.
There we go. Basketball. We used to go Saturday school, church.
Before we go, because he's a pretty boy, you know what I mean? You're a tall guy. You know what I mean? You're model-esque. Like, there's also this in play here. Like, your mum must have just seen it and just had the vision, just been like, actually, you know what? Grow that.
Yeah, man. And I definitely think part of it is my parents both being born in London. They were both born, you know, my dad's Kensora, my mum literally North London and then East London. So they both like, and inner London as well. They're both Londoners. My parents, if you hear them speak, my mum's very near enough Cockney. My dad is like, he speaks quite a lot, similar accent to me. Mm. And like, I just think them having that worldliness and knowing the city, my mum just knew what could be done if you just make use of what the city is. And she just understood it. And she was also able to keep me like away from, you know, my area obviously had a lot of trouble in it growing up. And you know, there's a combination of things. My street happened to be like one of the few areas in the whole ends that doesn't actually have a prominent gang. That definitely helped me.
Well, it doesn't.
It doesn't. The end of the road, there's an estate, but that's not our road. Do you know what I'm trying to say? It's like you got to go and then it's away and then there's an estate there. But that's not my road. And then there's estates there. But then that's... So there were gangs, but I grew up in this little bubble of my area where there was none.
So lucky.
Luck. Bro, I'm telling you, because I had an auntie that lives at the end of the road on the estate where there was a gang. And when I used to go through there, bro, like on more than one occasion, they tried to recruit.
Really?
Yeah, like literally.
You didn't
like,
have cousins though that were...
My auntie had no children at the time. She had children now. Right. At the time, she was like my dad's younger sister.
I thought you were going to say that they were recruited or something.
Well, they tried to recruit like me and my brother, but... I remember him coming up to us one time. We were walking through the estate and a guy comes up to me. He goes, yo. I said, yeah. And he goes, oh, like, yeah, bro. Like, well, you from around here, yeah? And I was just like, yeah, he's from down there. And he goes, oh, where? And I said, he went, oh, them ones. And he says to me, yo, like, a couple of people are meeting up at this time here. Like, well, roll true, fam, roll true. And I was quite young. I think I was about 13. I just went, I didn't even say words. You know when you're just like that young that you don't even know what to say? I said, Anyway, I remember him saying something like, and don't just nod, fam, like, actually be there. Bro. And I just did it again. Like, yeah. I just went in. My dad picked me up. You know what I mean? I was just like, oh, God. I'm not going to turn up to the
meeting. That would have shook me.
Do you know what I mean? So what I'm saying is that if I had grown up on that estate, bro, like we used to, me and my brothers, we used to play outside on our street, but we were playing with just people that just play football, bro. No one was a gang member. on my street. Mm. There were people that were linked to it, but they were quite a lot older. So, like, the fact is, I had the luck, and I've always said this, like, because when I think about, like, how comes I ended up getting into nothing like that, I say, my mum kept, but, bro, I got friends whose mum also knew the city and had them doing performing arts, but that's not really what it is, bro. Like, I can name famous people now. I'm not going to say anyone because I just think it's weird to be dropping names, but there's... It's public knowledge, but I'm still not going to say it because I just think it's weird. But, like, there's famous people now who are big actors who, when they were younger, their mums had them going to performing arts school and that, but they still got into gang culture. Mm. So it's not just that. I believe, bro, it was my surroundings. I think just the street I grew up on was lucky enough to, despite not being far from where gangs are, it's just not where the gangs were. As a result, it just didn't touch us. Mm. It's like being, you're in a bubble. And bro, by the way, it's not like the road I grew up in is like, oh, it's the luxury part of an area. It's not the luxury part. It's just the normal part of my area.
It was just an off-frontline thing. Boom, that wasn't
that's
there.
It just wasn't on the front line.
Wow.
That's it.
So then going back to the Top Boy analogy, that must have been an absolute bonkers situation I'm going to be this guy.
Yeah, it was. And it's funny you say that because, like, obviously, if I tell somebody where I'm from later, they'll think, oh, you must know about that.
Yeah.
I do know about it, but I know about it through what friends have experienced. Mm. I know about it through what I've seen. Like, I won't lie to you. My road was a bubble, but because of that, it meant that it used to get passed through a lot. So there were murders that happened on my road.
Right.
More than one occasion.
Layton's a tough...
That's it. Especially before. Now, yeah. I'll say this now, because I'm not even going to front. There is stuff that goes on, as with every area that gets gentrified.
Yes, right.
The trouble never goes. We both know this.
Yeah.
But on the surface, it's a different place to what it was on the surface back then. And you know that's how gentrification works. It changes the cover.
Yes, that's right.
It's like changing the book
behind
cover.
The
you've still got the book. There we go. You've still got the content. It's just, it looks... Maybe they changed the book cover and the first four chapters aren't the same anymore.
But when you get into the
book, it's still the same area.
That's right.
You know what I'm coming from? There we go. Absolutely. And that is like what I would say Leighton is now. But when I was growing up, yeah, it was, you know, I would still come back and the road would be taped up because a murder had happened, like people passing through from one end to another. Mm. You get me? And also... My road is one of the only roads that links Leytonstone and Leighton.
Okay,
so, you come through mine and then you go through the other side and you get through the back to get back to South Leytonstone. You get me? So it was like a pass-through for that reason. Mm. But like, yeah. So it was weird, my being cast in Top Boy, because as I said, somebody would think, oh, you know, like Leighton, you must be. But bro, the truth is, there are guys from areas like Romford who know more about that world in terms of experiential living than me, because they were actually in a gang. Areas like Romford have gangs as well, so like you know what I mean. So like there are people that literally could be from a gang in Romford who have more experience of the world of Top Boy in terms of what they've lived than I do, even though I'm from Leighton, which was known for gangs at one point. You get me?
Yeah.
And it's because even I could see it around me, and I had friends that were in it. But I just wasn't in it.
Yeah, Top Boy also highlights certain aspects of that. It brings it to the forefront. You know, a lot of people, a lot of people love the idea of the gang thing, but I don't think they really know the details and how deep it runs.
Well, let me tell you something, yeah. There's a guy that I know, bro, who's from Cornwall. Bro, he's from Cornwall, and I was chatting to him the other day. He was chatting to me and a guy from Tottenham. Well, let me tell you something. This guy from Cornwall, he knows as much about gang culture as any London kid, because
really?
He grew up on an estate in Cornwall, bro.
Yeah, that's right.
You see me, fam?
Yeah, man.
He was a young guy. Shot him, bro. He can tell you how to cook up any drug.
Mm.
This guy can tell you ingredients, like, from, because, bro, when he was, because he looked innocent, but he grew up on an estate in Cornwall, from when he was like 12, older guys.
Yeah, grabbed him.
Yo, because no policeman's going to suspect you, you get me? He was there. Bro, and this guy can sit in front of any guy, bro, and tell them how to bag up anything, how to cook anything, how to... Any drug you're talking, bro, because he was doing this from a young age, bro.
Yeah.
You get me? Now, if you look at him, you just think he's this artistic indie guy, bro. Mm-hmm. Bro, what he's living
really,
through... Yeah, he just looks like an indie kid, bro, because he's got the tattoos and all that, and he's like a rocker, he plays guitar and like Converses. He looks like one of these American sort of like rock kids, you get
Blink
me?
Blink 182 like, kind of thing.
Bro, almost, yeah, I'm not going to lie. But what he's lived and what he can talk about, like, say I'd known him when I was doing Top Boy, he would have been part of my research.
But would have been totally like, doesn't fit the description.
Somebody would think that, innit? Yeah, bro. And if you looked at me and him, and this is what I love you, if you saw me and him on a train and somebody said to you, which one of these two do you think has been a drug dealer in your life? Someone's going to say me.
Yeah.
I've never been one in my life. My boy, on the other hand, boy from Cornwall, very well spoken, has very well read, very intelligent, watch artistic, cultural, watch tons of films. He can tell you literally the first, like, I mean, from about 11, 12 years doing it, like, for a good 10 years, that was his universe, bro.
Stereotypes suck.
You see what I mean? You see what I mean?
Do you even now, like, go to ask, do you think people, you know, for you, Alex, to be like that guy, do you still think people see you as that guy from Top Boy? Do you think that, because you are such a powerful character, and like, you know, do you think that that stereotype, do you think people think that you genuinely are like that kind of character?
Yeah, definitely, when they don't know me.
It's bonkers, isn't it?
Could not believe that. So obviously I told you, I was in my boy's music video, innit? I'm not plugging it, but I'm going to say it for the sake of context. I'm in a video by my brethren, Shemzy. Called I Can Feel It. Yeah, it's a garage track, and in the video we're all catching a vibe. You get me, bro? It's like we're all in Leighton, sun shining. Like the video will give you the energy, but the point is we're having a great day. You get me? Just partying to the song, and in the video we're all having fun. We're catching a vibe. We're not trying to be cool. We're not taking ourselves too seriously. We're just enjoying ourselves. And if you watch it, you will see me doing that. And there are people that have watched that. Yeah, my guy Shemzy told me that, like, he was showing it to some people. And one of them was like, is that the guy from Top Boy? Yeah. Oh, it's weird to see him acting like that. The guy was like, it's weird to see me having fun like that. Because you can't imagine the character. Because you know what it is? And I was even chatting about this to my guy the other day. I said to him, I find it weird when I watch Top Boy. Because I'm nothing like that, I can't really take the character as seriously. Like, when I was playing it, I was taking it seriously. When I'm watching it, it's just like, imagine you watch yourself on something. Yeah? Just imagine you watch back one of your podcasts and one day you watch it and you just got an Australian accent and you seem like a farmer. Yeah. You watch it and think, what? And that's how I feel when I watch Top Boy. I just think, this is too, it's like looking in the mirror and seeing something different. It's weird, bro.
Yeah.
If I watch this podcast, I don't feel weird because I know my essence, right? Mm. You spend every day of yourself. You hear your thoughts every day, right? Mm. Every day you see yourself in the mirror. Every day you hear your voice. You become so accustomed to how you are. Suddenly you play a character where you've made a lot of effort to get away from who you are. And then when you watch it for 8 episodes, I'm telling you now, it's very hard for your mind to get married to this idea as believable. You can't.
Any actor, I think that is the hardest thing to equate in your head.
Yeah.
You've really got to believe the character that you're going
That's
to be.
That's it. Now, the people watching, bro, they don't know what I'm like. Mm. So when they watch it, they take that character for truth.
That's you.
That's it. So, bro, I'm telling you now, like, bro, there's been girls who have wanted to meet up with me because they're attracted to that character.
To the bad man.
To the bad man, bro. And they meet me. I remember one time I was seeing this girl and she goes... She just randomly messaged me one day. Oh, and you got that deep voice as well, innit? I'm thinking, rah, you've really had thoughts about this character.
Okay, right, let's get into this. Right, so the girl thing. Mm-hmm. The girl thing with the characters you play. Because this could only be testament to you as an actor and how well, you know, conveyed the character is, embodied in you. Girls, when hitting you up, Guy Ritchie, for instance, he's like, "Yo, I want you to be this. I want you to play this role. I want you to," and you're like that. Do you ever think in the back of your mind, it's like, "Oh, this is gonna fuck some people out. I'm gonna get some weird DMs now or some shit."
Bro, I didn't think I was gonna get everything with the Top Boy. I was shocked,
really?
Bro. I was shocked, bro. Like I did an ITV thing, bro, called The Unforgotten. I was in one episode of that, and I had girls message me for that character. The Top Boy one blew me away, though, bro, because he's like a sociopathic mass murderer, essentially. Mm. He's a hitman. Like. I watch that character, I think, what on earth does any girl see in that? And anyway, I've asked a couple, and what they say is, like, you know, it's just how much he doesn't give a fuck. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think, we're not going to get too deep into this one, but it appeals to a slightly animalistic side of the human brain. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
I can't remember the murderer. I'll find it and I'll pop it
Ted up. Bundy?
That's one. Yeah, and he had like the big following of girls in the courtroom.
Even still, there are girls that call him sexy.
Yeah.
But I remember I was chatting to this girl once and she described Ted Bundy as sexy. We never spoke much again after that day. I'm not a joke. And that's the reason, by the way.
Yeah.
Because I just thought, yeah, that's too weird. I'm sorry.
That's a freaky weirdness.
You get me? But like, bro, like there is... I mean, look, man, when I'm not going to sort of like, this is definitely a topic for another day, like when we're just in a pub, but like, there is a side of like darkness that a lot of people have in the back of their heads. That, so in the fantasy sense, it does get people's minds, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, and that's all part of the, again, I guess it's a high-class problem when you're playing a good role as an actor.
Yeah, mate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I've had girls audition me who literally are turned on by the character. They are. Yeah. I know it. And then they meet me, and then they have to... They love my appearance or whatever. That's also cringy just saying that, but they do. But they fall in
talk
love.
Talk that shit. It's your podcast, baby.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, you know what I mean? But they fall. They have to then... They then fall for the fact that I've come across as cultured. You see what I'm trying to say? And, bro, you know
super cultured.
And I think, I believe, bro, the combination of that then actually turns them on more.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm coming
yeah,
from?
Yeah,
because they never... It's like, oh, I don't really want to say this, man. Should I say it? Wait, let me just think if it works. Okay. I got it. You see, maybe there was a girl in school and she was the buffest girl in school.
Yeah.
Years later when you finish school, she don't look as good as she does in school. But because you remember her being the buffest in school, she never loses that shine.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't look as buff now as she did in school. She doesn't... You getting me, fam?
Shemzy's like...
But the trace of it will always remain. Now, I think with the character, they might have found the character attractive. They meet me, I'm like the character, but they will never lose now the trace of the character in their mind because I did it. They've
so
seen it. So I'm not like that, but it, that feeling of the character remains because they understand it as a side of me. So maybe, like, they might be... When we're talking, for example, and I'm a bit annoyed about something, and they might ask you, oh, blah, blah, and I answer without, you know, a lot of good energy and a little thing... That gives them a little flash. Ooh, that was a bit like the character.
Mm.
Do you see what I mean?
Wholeheartedly
get
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
I think from every creative, I mean, sometimes I'll be sitting there talking to a bunch of people and I'll say something that might be a signature of a conversation on the podcast and they're like, shit, for a second there, I thought we was on a podcast. Do you know what I mean?
There we go.
It's that
there
same sort of narrative,
that,
isn't it?
And you never lose that. It's like, bro... I imagine that. Imagine you watch a newsreader every day and they have that voice. And in recent news, Kensal Rise has been listed as one of the most upcoming areas in London. I imagine that if you met them in real life, they would have a little bit of that in the voice. So maybe you're at the bar. You know what I'm saying? Do you want anything to drink, mate? An apple juice and possibly some ice wouldn't go amiss. Like, I don't think they'll say it like that. Yeah.
But I feel like
I
would...
You know what I mean? Like, that sort of like...
I still feel like I'd
something
need to...
of it will find its way into their voice, bro. Like.
But I still feel like I'd need to finesse Trevor McDonald a little bit to get a smile, though. Do you know what I mean? I don't feel like he's not going to like... I don't think he'd ever going to like drop out of that kind of astute character.
I met Joseph Marceau, who used to play Jeffrey in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Oh, talk to me.
Yeah, bro. So I met him at the Barbican. I was watching a production, a Shakespeare production. And like, he was sitting in front of me. And I was like...
I wouldn't have been able to cope, mate.
But you know, these times, I think I was only 23. So there's a certain lack of like tact I had. I would be so different now. But I was like, oh, Jeffrey. I didn't even think of his name. I didn't think to Google it. I just went... Jeffrey from The Fresh Prince, like almost like.
Without thinking, it's like Tourette's.
As I thought it, I said it. I looked, Jeffrey from Fresh Prince. He looked up, he went, when he looked forward, I went, man, it's a pleasure to meet you. And he went, Fresh Prince? Dear boy, that was 22 years ago. And you know what, yeah? I just felt dumb. So, you know, but you know what I said? I said, yeah, but I mean, look at the character. It stood the test of time. I see you and I just get great memories of a show that I sort of flipped it on him. Because I made him, like, instead of, he was sort of saying it in a like, don't you know anything else I've done ever since, dear chap? But my whole thing was like, yeah, 22 years ago and it's still seen as one of the most legendary sitcoms of all time. You're an icon.
Yeah.
And then he sort of softened a bit. He sort of was like, yes, you regularly see the Shakespeare. It was that sort of thing, like, you know what I mean? And then we had a little chat and, yeah, so, and then he left during the interval. It was funny. And I saw him, I was like, you're going. Oh, I don't want to say what he said, but the point is he went. You know what I mean?
You know what? And we'll get into the theatre side of things in a minute because I know you've been busy. But interestingly, you can't, as an actor, you can't hate on that. I always think about people like David Jason, you know, and he falls on horses. You know, do people expect him to be walking around with, you know, with a cigar and kind of, you know, being a bit
being
wide?
A lad, yeah. Like he's in the show, yeah.
Do you, I mean, these characters, they forge such an imprint in our heads, and it must be quite hard at times to shake off that character. You're in good place because, you know, you're early in your career, but some of these guys, they've done the same character.
Oh, bro,
forever.
Like, for example, consider Steve McFadden, yeah?
Yeah.
Bloody Phil Mitchell.
Yeah.
He's got to be Phil Mitchell. Or like Adam Woodjack, who played Ian Bill. Like, they played these characters for years and they've become icons. Like, I wonder if the man who used to play Mr. Blobby just sounds like that now. You remember Mr. Blobby?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
When that was, do you not think that was a bit scary?
All day.
Yeah, I thought that was scary.
All day. Never got it, never strange. Understood it.
The guy that plays Barney, I saw him in an interview with him in it, and he's just this like, I don't know, bro. Do you see that quality that Barney has? That weird thing. The guy who plays him definitely sort of
has that
strange energy like that. But like back to those people, those actors who play those characters for years. Bro, if you're David Jason and you're playing a character as iconic as that, or like, bro, think of the Corrupt FM guys. There's no way that that's not their humour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They've got to, but there's an element of their personality.
But there has to be, bro, because they do that thing. So you know what, yeah? I was watching the BBC. I'm going to say this now. The first person that told me about Corrupt FM is my brother here, Shemzy, yeah? But I hadn't seen anything from them. I saw them in a Georgia Smith video, first ever time in my life. And then I didn't watch anything from them. I just thought, my boy told me that they're like a Garage Crew spoof. I went, fair enough, accepted it. Never saw them. Last night, my boy from Cornwall, the one I'm telling you about, he goes to me, he goes, I used to live in Brentford at one point. And then he goes, oh, it was just like people just do nothing. I said, what's that? Last night. And he goes, I said, what's that? He goes, it's a blah, 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 Corrupt FM. I said, I know about Corrupt FM. And then I went home on YouTube, people just do nothing. I couldn't, you have to go to like buy the episode. Yeah, so, yeah. So I just watched their BBC One Extra takeover. Brother, I was impressed. I was impressed. And I said to myself when I was watching it, what? Nah, there's no way that the outside of this, they're completely unlike this. They can't be. Because it's like, they do this a lot. And they must, you know what I mean? It's like when I saw the in-betweeners in an interview, yeah?
Yeah,
I thought there were a lot like the in-betweeners. So the fact that, and don't get me wrong, you know, they grow beards and sit with their legs crossed because they're intellectuals when they're not. You know how actors can be sometimes? Yeah, yeah. You have a beard and, you know, when I play that role, I thought, is that, you know what I'm saying? Like,
but for
like,
those of you who are listening and watching,
yeah, there we
you
go,
just like, nailed it.
Yeah. But I still thought that their energy was very similar to what they do on screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And the simple fact of the matter is, bro, like, this is the difference between what I did in Top Boy and what they did. I could play that character in Top Boy for 20 years and I promise you I'd still act nothing like that because I have to go a distance from myself to do it. Just when I used to get on set, fam, I had a whole way of getting into character. I used to, like, ask the production coordinators and that, like, from this point on, I'll get to a certain point, I'll talk, be normal on the way to the set and everything, be cool, get out of the car, see my production coordinator, she's a legend. What are you saying, bro? Quick convo. And I used to say to her, all right, we have a good energy, have a good chat about the latest albums we've heard because she was a big music fan, chat about some films. When I was about to go into my trailer, I said, when I go in, from that point on, let's not do anything that demands me to talk. Like, from this point on, I can't have conversations. I'll say, knock, and whatever you need me to do, I will do it. But please, and tell the others that I can't now just talk about stuff.
Because you fall out of character.
Yeah, it's because I get in, put my costume on, I'll take up my character biography, read it with my character biographies, bro, the way I am with them, bro, like, to talk about the craft for a second.
Please, craft.
Yeah, so, like, I write everything from time with it. Like, bro, be that guy, yeah, but like, for example, yeah, I'm gonna give you, like,
he grabs his phone,
yeah, man, like, I've got, like, a character biography, yeah,
wow,
one character I played, I got all of my
characters. This is in your Google notes,
yeah, I got all my character biography saved, like, and like,
so you'll be sitting on the tube or
I'll
train
get into the, yeah, so like, if I'm doing a film, I'll get into the trailer, as I said, on the way there, I'm chatting to the Uber driver, blah blah blah, you just free your mind,
show me what you're gonna show me,
so I'll be chatting to, and then I'll see the production coordinator, what are you saying, blah blah blah, we have a quick chat, yeah, my week is good, yeah, are you looking forward to today, yeah, I can't wait, blah blah blah, blah, blah. What breakfast you want, can I just have, like, English breakfast, yeah, cool. Then I'll say, just before I go into my trailer, I'd say, alright, I'm gonna go in and get into character now, from this point on I can't just talk, I can't just be me now. I'm going to have to, you know, I'm not disappearing, but the point is, I have to get in because the character that I was playing in Top Boy was too demanding for me to not do that.
It
was
just, a lot of energy.
It demanded too much of my head and it demanded such a different vibe from me. I couldn't just be like, and then Thierry Henry scored a mad goal and then do a scene. I can't do that.
But you can see that in the performance. Like, that's where the conveying of that to camera is so real and people genuinely get...
Oh, literally, bro. Even when the director will be chatting to me, I'll be like this. That's how I used to listen.
Well, just like head down like the character.
Yep. I had this guy that was like playing one of my characters, like, heavy, isn't it? And we wouldn't talk. I would just be, he'd be like, oh, so how long have you been doing this? And I just would stay quiet. And then I looked at him and just went, And he got what I meant. I didn't, you know what I mean? And I wasn't being a dickhead, but the point is, the first day on set, Ashley Waters, he didn't say like, yo, how good to... The first day I come on set, he was stood there by the riverbank, ready to do his scene. Mm. When I came, it was a quick... But then once we had done the initial, what are you saying?
That's cool, the end of it.
That was it. There
was it the
like
same
a,
with him then? So Ashley was like in character that...
Not
in the same
that.
Way.
Well, after that day, like he was more familiar. But that first day, because we were playing adversaries and we'd never met, we had never met. I hadn't met Ashley Waters. He hadn't met Alessandro Babalola. I was meeting him as Duchesne.
Yeah.
So there wasn't like a, hey, buddy. It wasn't that. It was like, he was already in character.
That must have been mad.
Yeah, he was in character. And I had to, I was in character. So I just saw, and we met each other as basically...
enemies.
Almost like, it's like we went on autopilot for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
So he didn't suddenly become Ashley Waters and go, yo, what are you saying? And I didn't become Alessandro Babalola and go, so solid legend, man. You know, start naming all of his credits to him. It was just like autopilot, we're normal people. But not even ourselves, just... good to meet you.
Nice one. Mad. So,
comeback characters. Boom. Because there was an understanding that, like, we can't get too deep into who we are right now because we are actually about to be these enemies.
Yeah.
There's no point establishing this familiarity when we're about to literally play adversaries. We've just met. We might as well use our lack of familiarity to fuel the fact that the characters are meeting properly for the first time.
Yeah.
So on the day I met him, right, the day I met him is the same day that our characters have full interaction. You get me? So when you see that scene where me and that one, the famous one, not Do You Respect Sugar...
Mm.
Because the first day we actually shot
crazy
was the scene when we were on the riverbank, and I'm saying that if you don't, you know, bring your drugs, you ain't getting them. If they're 2 minutes late, you ain't getting them. All that stuff. That was the first day I met him.
That's crazy.
And we'd met maybe 10 minutes before. So in a way, that's the character's first proper meeting, because obviously there's a part when I shoot him, but they didn't meet then. He just says, "Do you respect Sugar?" That wasn't a meeting. That was a threat.
Mm.
The first time they meet is when they meet in London, and that was the first time we'd met. So, you know what I'm saying?
Wow.
But like, so in terms of...
Let's get back to this. So, yes.
Character biography, yeah.
Yeah, character biography. Right, man.
So that gives you an example. I played a character in a play recently. And like, let me just give you like the first couple lines with
do
the biography.
It. Yeah. Right?
My name is Wayne Oluwashon Thompson Agbani. I was born on the 26th of November, 1972 in Barnet Hospital to a Nigerian father called Williamson Omobawale Opeyinka Agbani, born 3rd of October, 1938, 34 at the time of my birth, and the Jamaican Mercy Denise Thompson, born 12th of May, 1945, 25 at the time of my birth. My mother was an NHS nurse and my dad was a logistician for the army. They met when my mum treated my dad in hospital as he lived in Barnet at the time, which is why I was born there. My mum actually lived in Tottenham, but she worked at Barnet Hospital. My parents were never married, but we lived in a big house in Barnet until I was 7, 8, at which point my dad left her for a white woman, left the house and became estranged, so we couldn't afford the house payments anymore. My mum and I moved back to the flat she was renting from an elder church uncle and auntie in Tottenham called Uncle Anthony and Auntie Phyllis, who were like grandparents to me. Because of the foundation my dad had set, I went to a really good private primary school in Barnet called St. Patrick's and St. Helens Church of England School. It was an idyllic private school with predominantly white students, as Barnet was a very white area at the time, etc. Moving on, blah, 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 blah. The teasing changed. It got worse by the time I went to secondary school in 1983. The first secondary school I went to was Wesley Green, a poorly rated school off West Green Road in Tottenham. Bullying was rife there. I fell into some bad grounds. Blah, 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 blah. I listened to dub, you know, jungle music, hung around the Broadwater Farm, blah, 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 blah. You know, my mum was troubled by what was going on with me in school and used one of her connections at the hospital in Barnet to have me move to St. Edmund's Grammar School in Highgate in year 11, 1987, to do my A-levels. It was full of... Bro, it's like, it's a character biography, bro.
That's...
everything, you know, like you go a bit more forward, like for example, like
mad.
That,
I mean, how do you even get to?
You just go in, bro. You like didn't do well in my A levels, got most CDs, but wasn't too motivated. Went to Haringey Community Technical College and did courses in brickwork and carpentry, engineering and electricianship. I was there from 1988 to 1991 when I was 19. When I finished, I tried to get a couple engineering apprenticeships, electrician apprenticeships, blah 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 blah. Running around in Tottenham, but in '90s the police operation got even more intense. They were looking to book you for anything, blah 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 blah. In college, I started dating one Antiguan Jamaican girl called Shanae. She was basically my first true love. Had our first child, you know, in December 18th, 1995, Shania, when we were both 23, but broke up a year later in 96. It got too tough and she felt that I wasn't ambitious enough. Bro, it's detail.
Virtual
character. 10 pages.
10 pages of
that's
just knowing a person.
Of biography of me writing a whole backstory. Now, when you go and watch the play, you see the play from whenever it starts. But in order to step on... Okay, let me break it down, Killer Killer, yeah? I sit here now, yeah? The reason why I'm able to talk to you about everything I'm talking about is because I've lived the 20-something years up until this point.
Yeah.
That's why
So you've got to reverse engineer the character.
You have to do that. You can't just play a character and just go words on the page.
Like an avatar. You're creating an avatar.
That's it. The writer, a writer, a rapper, a beat... Everything we do in art, yeah, you couldn't do it if not for all of the years you've lived.
True.
When my boy writes lyrics, when I make a beat, when I compose something, got piano, if I write a script, when you do a podcast, when you make an album, when you beatbox, you can't beatbox, bro, right? Unless you've heard all the music you've heard in your life. Mm. You can't, because that has created the musical sound palette of your head.
Yeah.
Exactly, right? That's coming from experience. So if, for example, an actor is playing a beatboxer, they cannot just not ever practice beatbox and then turn up on set and do it. You have to practice so much in your room as if you were someone who's grown up doing it. You need to read about beatbox culture. You got to understand it. You got to know its history. Do you know why? Because you cannot play a character who's so into something and you yourself know nothing about it. I can't go on stage and play a character and just read the words, because bear this in mind, the writer who wrote it could only have written that character because of the however many lives they lived. So I haven't lived that but writer's life, so I can't play it from their head. Therefore, I have to create a backstory that means that when I turn up on set or on in the theatre, I'm able to act as though there is a whole life I've lived. Now, bear in mind, you combine it with your own life, because, for example, there's things in there that will be inspired by things I've seen and experienced. For example, I can name areas. I wouldn't say the character was born in Barnet if not for the fact that I've been to High Barnet. It combines what you know with blah, blah, blah. But the point I'm trying to make is that you can't just turn up and play a character. Think of the difference between, like, Why can we freestyle? If you freestyle rap, you can do it because you've lived. Why can't...
Off the head,
my
yes,
son,
absolutely.
You know how he freestyle raps? My son, he's about to be four. He freestyle raps like this. There'll be a beat on... And he'll say, oh no, where's my nappy? Oh no, it's here. Then he'll go, da, 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 da. Because he hasn't got enough content to freestyle other stuff.
Oh.
So he freestyles the world he knows. Would he be saying that in 20 years? No, because he's going to know more than nappies. And it's the same with playing a character.
Feel the well.
That's it. You can't play, you can't just be given a script and be told, we're doing a full run of a play, we start tomorrow. No. No.
How long's the run-up? How long's the lead-up to learn?
2 weeks. 2 weeks. So
2 weeks of just solid on it.
Practicing, yeah. And over the course of that, yeah, like, don't get me wrong, I don't write this without knowing the script inside out, because there's an old saying, if it's not on the page, it's not on the stage. Everything that you put in the character has to come, it's got to be...
Oh, gosh, you are just dropping gems today,
bro. You get me? And then everything in the character that I've written has... I would not have written anything that I didn't think match what I've read. I read the script and I notice all these things about the character. I go, okay. All right. And then I think, this is who I am. This is who the character is. Blah, 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 blah. All right. So, okay, at this point in the script where he gets really angry and it seems like he's got angry for no reason. But then people that get angry for no reason, there might be a route to why they get angry easily. So you think about stuff like that. And then I'm reading another part of the script. I go, God, he gets really like cagey whenever she asks him if he wants something. What is that? Where does that come from? What did he go through in his childhood that has meant that he has a hard time taking a favour? You've got to link everything to something. You can't just say it's there for no reason. There's got, you know, all of our characters, like if somebody meets Killer Keller and says he's a congenial nice guy, would you be a congenial nice guy if you'd grown up being like, look, I don't know your upbringing, but the point I'm trying to make is that, like, you've gone through stuff in life that has made you the balanced person you are. Right? If I was playing you in a film, I'd need to work out what caused that. Because not everybody's balanced. You don't just walk around. If some people are a bit off edge. Anybody you meet that seems on edge, is there a reason they're on edge? Yes, there is. There's something in their life. As an actor, you have to establish those things in your prep. Otherwise, you're just going onto stage and just saying words. So why are you saying it like that? Why do you do it like that? Why does a character think like that? If there's a character in the play and the actor finds her attractive, right? And if there's a character that your character finds attractive, since when is your character like girls like this?
And when does that derive from?
When did that start? In school? Did he meet? So you plot everything in. You got to work it out. For example, if I'm in a film, right? And the character speaks, he's got three children, and he speaks fondly about one child but the other two, I have to know in my head why it is that he's not speaking fondly about the other two children. So is it that the one he's speaking fondly of, that her mother is the only one he loved? The other two, he didn't really love their moms. There are all these problems, which means blah, 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 blah. But then the one he speaks that he's like their favorite, they're his favorite child. Him and their mum had a real connection.
That's real.
You gotta understand the roots of why your character does. So basically, the great actors like Robert De Niro, Jack Nicholson, Dustin Hoffman, bro, all great actors, Denzel Washington, bro, Tom Cruise.
They study.
All of them do this. They create these biographies because it brings reality. Otherwise, if I don't read that biography before I step on set or before I step on stage, I'm stepping on stage as Alessandro Babalola. I'm not stepping on stage as a character.
God.
Understand?
Oh God!
I read that, and then my mind feels like it's been like, bro. Think of what happens when you listen to a song you love. Yeah, it changes your mood. Mm-hmm. The character, the biography, changes the mood of my brain. And when I say changes the mood, it's like it redesigns the whole furniture of my brain to fit the characters. And then I'm under the illusion.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now I'm under the illusion of the character, and now I can commit to the false truth that I'm about to have to deliver for the next hour or 2 hours on stage. If I turn up to the theater, I've got a couple of things I've got to do before I get on stage. I've got to do my warm-up, physical warm-up, vocal warm-up, and then I've got to do my brain warm-up. And my brain warm-up is reading that. If you made me choose, are you going to do your brain warm-up, the physical warm-up, or the vocal warm-up? I'm choosing the brain warm-up.
The brain warm-up, does that send... Because that's quite a... That's a read, and it's quite a character to fall into. Theatre, by the way, which we're getting into now, is the cutting chops of every actor's...
Yeah.
You know, this is where you separate the men from the boys with theatre, right?
You could argue, definitely, yeah.
So you're right. I'm just painting a picture here because I know that feeling before I go and do something. And sometimes if I feel pressured or rushed or have an anxiety towards it, and you're looking at a script like that, or you're looking at the background of someone's history to create a persona, that can be quite intense. Do you ever feel like the anxiety's there? Do you ever feel like, oh, fuck, what if I don't get this right? Because for a lot of people, that's the real...
Believe it or not, yeah, this takes away my anxiety.
Really?
Yeah. If I don't... This is what I said, if I have to choose between the three. Vocal warm-up, physical warm-up, brain warm-up. Mm. The brain warm-up is me reading my character biography.
That's cold.
When I read it, bro, I don't do this. I don't say it out loud. Mm. I sit quietly in my dressing room. Mm. I turn off the lights. Everybody knows my process. I shut my door. If the stage manager needs to let me know that we're on stage in 5 minutes, he just goes... addresses me my character name. I go, yep. And he goes, that's your 10-minute call. I go, thanks.
Oh, my God. You've really thought through the physical...
There we go.
What it is to fall into.
That's it. And I sit in my room with the lights off. And, bro, I just quietly read it. Like, literally, like, if you were to watch it, it would look like this. Just read it.
And it just fills you up.
Just sink it into my head. I don't remember it off head. I don't walk onto the stage saying it in my head. When I was born in 19... I don't do that. You just read it. You read it and you go... That's it. You just put the phone to the side. All right, I'm ready. From that point on, whenever I talk to you, I can now be... The stage manager can come to me and go, have you got all your props? And I'll be like, yeah, I got all of the props. But in my head, I'm the character now.
That quantum leap.
It's that. It's just that. It's very simple. And you don't read it and suddenly go, I am now, and start acting different. It's just you read it. You sort of... You know what I mean? You got to, like... The reason why I read it quietly with the lights off is you want to absorb it.
Yeah.
You want to absorb it. I don't rush read it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if I'm late on my way to the theatre and I think I won't have enough time to read it when I get to the theatre, I read it on the train. Put my earphones in, play something like that reminds you of the I've got a lot of instrumentals on my phone. I listen to why instrumentals? Because words from another rapper, they'll get into my head as I'm trying to read. I just listen to beats. I listen to a beat that puts me in the right mood and I read it. And bro, that brain warm up, I'm telling you now, as I said to you, bro, if I've got to choose between the three, I choose the brain one. Because ultimately, bro, yeah, acting is you got to hold up an illusion. I have to, my mind has to be convicted in the illusion for me to, I don't give a crap if I've stretched well and done my vocal warm ups. If that brain has not been warmed up, I cannot believe myself when I'm on stage.
Fall into.
Yep.
Segue a little bit. Art imitating life. When I did the graffiti podcast here, which is quite frequent, I was editing them, listening back. You know, I think I've done about 112, 113 graffiti podcasts on a weekly. And then it suddenly clicked in my head. I'm like, I know so much about these characters. I wonder what it'd be like to do it myself.
Yeah.
So then I got the can.
Mm.
Started doing it. All of a sudden, the feedback from that, as in, like, in my head to what I've heard to what I now know, adds value and weight to the conversations I have. My question is, have you ever gone to that distance where you've actually gone and experienced a thing that your character has just to taste a luxury or a physical equivocal of what to add value to your character? Have you ever done that to that extreme where it's like, actually, you know what? The only way, I mean, I'm not talking about anything rapey or weird. I'm talking more from a level of, you know what I mean? Like,
brother, you're asking the perfect questions. The most recent play I did, I had to play a character that was from Tottenham, but was doing a job in Highgate, right?
Mm.
He was a guy from Tottenham and he does a door-to-door sales job in Highgate. Now, this play is set in 2002. So the political climate and there's, you know, when I talk about political, I mean political correctness, socio-political climate, race relations was different in 2002 to what it is in 2021.
For sure.
I can't go back in time to 2002. So I would read a lot about 2002, London, and also just all the years, like from about 1980, I just would read everything from the Boardwater Farm riots to watching documentaries and all that, yeah. But then I also needed to compound that by going there. So you know what I'd do? We were rehearsing in Islington. After rehearsals, go to Tottenham. I'll go to Tottenham High Street. No joke. Walk, go sit in a Caribbean restaurant on West Green Road. Eat a patty. Eat some rice and peas and like oxtail. Curry go, you know, get my little saltfish fritter. You know,
hold tight, Tottenham crew, all
yeah,
day.
You get me? I'll sit in West Green Road, eat my Caribbean food. Normally, you know, sometimes I do it with glasses on because I didn't want people to recognise me from top wear. Sometimes I didn't mind because I wanted the conversation with some locals, you get me?
Ooh.
Chat with them. I'll finish that, right? And then you know what I'll do after that? Jump on the 241 from Tottenham High Road and go straight to Highgate Village. Go Highgate Village, walk around there.
Wow, dynamics.
That's it. You get me? Walk around Highgate Village now. The high street.
How did that feel? How did that feel going from one? Yeah.
Yo, this is what's amazing. Like, you know, Tottenham and Highgate aren't far from each other. No. They're both in, I mean, Highgate's in three boroughs, Camden, Haringey, and Islington.
Mm.
But, like, obviously, part of it's in Haringey and Tottenham is in Haringey. Mm. Tottenham is the east side of Haringey, Highgate's the west side of Haringey. All that really separates Tottenham and Haringey, speaking in broad terms, is Alexandra Palace.
That's right.
You get me? So you just go over Alexandra Palace. Okay, you're Wood Green, Alexandra Palace, Muswell Hill, bam, Highgate. Mm. But essentially, Muswell Hill and Wood Green, yeah, you know, they very much encroach Alexandra Palace. So you're essentially just going over Alexandra Palace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to get too technical, but Wood Green used to be West Tottenham. So it feels very contiguous with it geographically.
Mm.
So you've gone through now, you get over Alexandra Palace and then boom, 241 straight into bloody Highgate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bro, the contrast is mad. It's mad, bro. Kensal Rise and Harsden.
Yeah, totally.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But even bigger, because Kensal Rise still has that. You can get into the back streets.
Yeah.
Highgate doesn't have no back streets, bro. So like to even make it like even clearer for Northwest, it's Harsden and Hampstead.
Mm.
It's Harsden and Hampstead.
Yeah, 100%.
It's Harsden and Hampstead, bro.
And what a contrast.
It's just different universes, bro. Tottenham is like multicultural.
Mm.
It's far low, more way more low income. You get me? That's obvious. You get me? Far more council housing. Old, like, inner London, sort of like, you know, low income communities, which means, you know, that it gives an area an incredible community spirit, but it also means
a level of contentness as well.
There we go. But then there's also an underbelly of tension.
Yes.
We're aware of this. You get me? Because where life is hard, there's tension.
Mm.
Fact of life. Mm. You get me? We're all aware of that. Then you go to Highgate, where essentially people there live. Let me tell you something that happened once to me in Highgate, yeah? I was chatting to a person, and I said to them, what's it like living in Highgate? This was in when I was in character. And he goes to me, this is what the man said, he went, best place on God's earth. That's how he said it. It's the best place on God's earth. I went, yeah? And he went, I mean, it's become a bit of a plush thing now. You speak to somebody, and they say, oh, yeah, so I live in Highgate. But it really, there's nowhere else on earth I'd rather live. And I just thought, man, don't get me wrong, there's definitely people that love Tottenham, but I don't know how many people would speak about it with that level of adoration.
True.
And this is the essential difference, bro. Like me, I'm a Leighton guy, yeah? Born and raised in Leighton. Do I like Leighton? Yes. Do I love Leighton? Well, it gave me, I wouldn't be who I am without it. So, you know, in the same way you might say, yeah, I love my family because they're blood related. I love Leighton because I love it, but also on an almost familial level, it's in me, right? But would I ever call it the best place on God's earth? Mm-hmm. Bro, you couldn't pay me to say that. I wouldn't call anywhere in London the best place on God's earth,
bro. No, that's a lot, yeah.
I would need to see a lot more before I make declamatory statements like that.
So what do you reckon it is then? As somebody that was kind of falling into that character, going back to those places, or going to those places, and on reflection, where do you think that comes from? Where's that his statement come from?
Because they are content. Mm. People in Highgate are content. They're in a little bubble. Bro, let me tell you something. A lot of the nicest areas in London have a big hill that lead up to them.
Yeah.
You know this.
Yeah.
Hampstead, you got Haverstock Hill. Muswell Hill, you got Muswell Hill. Highgate, you got...
Yeah, that's right.
If you go up from Finsey Park, you got to go this long hill, bro.
Crouch End as well.
Crouch End and there, yeah. Hill, and then you're there. Yeah. And it's almost, there is a feeling of like, if you want to live here, well, you got to do the hard work of getting up that hill.
Oh.
And then you can be in the area. And you can see why they
keep the Hollywood Hills.
Out. Bro, literally, you get me? And you can see why they keep... It's even Chingford, yeah? I'm from Waltham Forest. The nicest part of my borough is Chingford. Mm. There's a big hill called Chingford Mount. And there's even hills all around Chingford that you've got to go up. Mm. You can't get from the rest of East to Chingford without going up a hill. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that, like, there is a feeling of, like, beyond that hill, they live in, like, a little paradise. Mm. That keeps them away from everybody else, right?
Safe.
And they got their little cafes, they got their little shops. And, bro, the rest of... the area, for example, think of Belsize Park, yeah? Mm. At the bottom of Haverstock Hill, you got Camden Town. Camden Town is where the roughness is, right? Mm. You got the drug dealers there, you got the ends there.
Yeah.
But up beyond the hills, you enter a different universe in Belsize Park and Hampstead, right? You get me? Bro, they, in all these areas, Highgate, Muswell Hill, Belsize Park, in those areas after the hill, they live in perfect little bubbles.
Ecosystems. Yeah.
That's it. Where they don't, you can, bro, like, let's just get it like this, yeah? The accent of Camden Town is not the same as the accent of Hampstead, and they're only separated by Haverstock Hill.
Yeah, true.
The accents of Highgate and the accent of Tottenham are different accents, yeah? I hear little kids, when I'm passing through all Highgate and Hampstead, bro, the kids, the youths there, they sound like this. No, but that's ridiculous. If I told Martha, she would never do that. That's how they sound. I've heard them chatting, bro. I hear them. When I'm walking through Hampstead,
you hear it, yeah.
Boom, I hear it. In Tottenham, they don't sound like that.
Nah.
I'm not going to do an impression of a Tottenham. Everybody can imagine what. We hear rap. We hear, you know, we know about culture, you know, all, the ends, you know.
But some of those kids take on a persona that they want to talk, behave, and they reimagine it in their heads and they want to be that thing. That's a character in itself.
They do. Definitely, because you get the sort of like, you get the sort of, the roles that like, for example, great example, I grew up, yeah, and like, the culture that I witnessed was a lot of grime culture, right?
Mm.
So I chatted to my boy about this whole thing of like, you see people like Wiley, Bushkin, Double E, Fusco. There's this quality they have, like they're young forever.
It's true.
You understand what I mean? Yeah. It's like they will never be old.
No.
You see the way they are, their energy.
Mm.
Like, bro, I read Wiley's biography, bro, and like, this whole, when he talks about when he was running around Limehouse and Bow and all these areas at 19... To what extent has he changed from that 19-year-old? He's seen life, he's matured and he's learned a lot, as I have since I was 19. Mm. But I do say to myself, I was saying this to my boy, like, I think that this thing they have of being young forever has really, bro, like, if you know the difference between the way a man sounds now versus the way men sounded in, like, 1995?
Yeah, I know.
They just sounded like they had deeper voices and they sounded... Now, obviously, somebody could... Some linguists or some sociolinguists would say to me, oh, well, that's for a number of reasons. I don't care. I'm speaking from my outside ignorant views, right? I think they sounded manlier then because they didn't have a culture that could keep them young for as long as the culture that we have.
Yeah.
You see what I'm trying to say, fam? Like, do you get me, bro?
Yeah.
There was a time when we were younger, yeah, where people would say things like, oh, if you ain't wearing jeans, like, you know what I mean, you're trashy. And then they'll hit this point in the world where suddenly it was like, actually, no, it's cool to wear tracksuits for the rest of your life. Maybe 2014 to 2016,
everything relaxes.
Yeah, you can wear tracksuits forever.
Mm.
Bro, suddenly you're seeing this thing there where, like, I don't know, like, obviously, grime is a big part of it because grime is, like, I would call it the first... Black youth street culture that I believe became just the way.
You see
the punk 100%. Scene of Camden, not everybody was a punk, right? Not everybody was a junglist. Whereas
you're
grime...
Right. Grime became... It is.
It was universal, bro. Everybody dressed like that way. And even if you were like...
Part of the subtext of every
Bro, grungers would use N-slang.
Yeah.
You get me? Everybody was affected to a degree by it. And I believe that... that culture has spread in a way that even if you look at Top Boy, could that not be called Top Boy, Adulthood, Kiddohood? They're almost like grime films.
Yeah.
You see what I'm trying to
say,
bro?
Like Le Haine was back for
France.
That's
it, bro. It become a wide cultural thing, yeah, fam. Like, Top Boy, like, is it a shock that a lot of these films have legends from garage and grime in them? Mm. Kano and Asha D are the leads of Top Boy. Mm. People, other people that have played roles in it, Lil Sims, Dave, flipping, what's Scorcher. You know, like, yeah. I could keep naming people, but I just can't remember them all off the top of my head. But the point I'm trying to make is that, like, Bashy.
Oh, my God.
You see what I'm
Bashy,
trying to say? Local legend, by the way. But, local, yeah, like, yeah, all these people, bro, are people that, like, were stalwarts of the genre that I believe was the most important youth culture in the history of London. Now, the way that's affected me, that's such a big segue, but the way it's affected me in terms of community roles is that I look now at the DEEs, who, for example, I see at my barbershop, yeah? I look at the Wileys, I look at the Jammers, all the just the legends of the scene, Bushkin, people like that, and I see that they don't act what I perceived 40 to be. They are young forever. That influenced me. I was literally on the phone to my brother the other day saying, bro, we're going to be young forever. Mm. Killer Keller, you're young forever, fam. Yeah. Because of what you did, bro, the beatboxing thing, it's, do you see what I mean? It keeps
it
your spirit
your
young.
Thing. Yeah,
will
right.
you ever be 50, bro?
Not mentally, no.
Do you see what I mean?
Do you think everybody feels that way, though? No. Like, if you're working in a 9-to-5 and that?
No, you don't.
I think we're very lucky people, aren't
that's
we?
That's it. Because what we do as creatives requires us to remain in touch with our child. It just does. Don't get me wrong. Some people go the Jay-Z route and they almost decide to become mature. Like, there's the thing, you know,
but do you think
glasses.
That's a perception? Do you think that's Jay-Z acting to a degree?
I think Jay-Z looked up to people who had to be more mature anyway. So if you think of certain albums like American Gangster and that, like, these are, like, characters that are just, like, proper adults. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
You get me? Whereas, like, nowadays, like, the rappers
got, like,
now...
Beyonce's got... Sorry to cut you, because I was just thinking about the two dynamics. Like, Beyonce's got the Sasha Fierce. She falls into a role, doesn't she?
But she's like an adult. She's not forever. Like, if they saw this, they'll probably say, how dare you say that? But they're grown up, man.
Mm.
Somebody like Kanye is an example of somebody who's forever young. He won't grow up, bro.
No, he won't.
He won't. You see him now, bro, with the do-rag on his head, like... With that thing where he's working on an album. Yeah. He's still just being... I remember one time he was saying in interviews, I don't take advice from anyone younger than me. He was just obsessed with saying this, fam, because his whole thing was, and I got it, he's trying to say, I'm staying young. See Travis Scott, bro, he's 30, but he comes across like a 24-year-old, right? And it's purposeful. It's to, like, it's to remain in touch with the spirit of creativity. Look at Goldie. Yeah. Goldie's not ever going to be 60.
He's not. He will never be 60.
He won't ever be 60. Look at Dizzy Rascal, bro. He will never be 45.
Because they're completely in touch with their creativity.
Because when you... There's a couple reasons. Number one, what we do as artists, it's not like classical music, which is very formal. It requires you to sort of like formalize your behavior, which is what the 9-to-5 world does to you, by the way. If you got to put on a suit every day, that changes your whole existence. If you got to get on the underground every morning, you know, get up early, you drink that coffee, you're doing emails, you're speaking formally, you have to talk formally at work. It changes how you are as a person.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I see people like that, you know. Prior to any lockdowns, there was a 9-to-5 culture where you'd just be stuck on a tube, smelling someone's armpit, someone smells a garlic, someone else is fucking reading newspaper.
It ages you.
Yeah, it does.
It ages you. It ages your behaviour. You mature.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas when you're creative, what, and you've got to get into a studio, hey, yo, come, let's catch a vibe, bro. Put on a beat. Let's just vibe out. You can't do that like a 9-to-5 corporate person. You have to be... You got to get the inner child. You get me?
Mm.
If I'm in a studio with my brethren, if I'm working on a script... A big part of what you've got to do is let loose. You've got to be free, like, okay, we're going to get artistic. Picasso and Henri Matisse, right? The two legends, bro, the painters, bro. We're going to go here, yeah? Let me tell you something about these two, yeah? Picasso and Henri Matisse, yeah, are seen as, like, amongst the greatest 100 artists in history, right? Cool. Do you know these men were obsessed with painting like children? So let me break down what I'm trying to say, yeah? Like, Matisse and Picasso were great friends, bro, and they were rivals, but they were friends, and they cared about being great artists, and they had this thing, like, of looking at each other's work and criticising it if it didn't feel childlike enough. So if you watch Picasso's self-portraits, bro, from the time he was, like, 7, when he was 15, he could paint himself, he could draw himself perfectly. He could draw a perfect portrait of himself, and his self-portrait literally looked real. If you see his self-portrait he did when he was 70, it looks like it was done by a 4-year-old. There's a picture of his, like, 10, 12 portraits.
Like Benjamin Button shit.
as it goes on, it gets less and less perfect. It becomes less and less formal. It becomes more abstract.
Is that him breaking down his creative process?
It's the idea. So, like, when they had children, for example, Emery and Matisse and Picasso, when they had children, they had this thing. Like, I remember on Picasso went around Matisse's house one day. And by this time, Matisse's first child was about 9, 10. So they were drawing themselves. And Picasso used to look at Matisse's drawings after his child was about 7, 8, whatever. And he'll say to him, "Your stuff is so much more visceral now." Mm. And he can tell this because he's taking in the child's energy. He's looked at the chick like... They were obsessed with this thing. Like, you see the old trope in art films of, like, an artist is being told to create something amazing.
Yeah.
And he can't think. He's like, I don't know what to do. And maybe he's got his son there. And then he goes, like, to have a phone conversation outside for, like, an hour. Mm. And his son has taken a paintbrush and just messed the whole room up. When he comes back in, he looks at the room. He goes, "What have you done? You've messed up the room." Like, and there's paint everywhere. He effed it up. And then the commissioner comes in and goes, "I love it. I love what you've done. This is amazing." Yeah. And then you don't know that the child's doing it. And then the painter's thinking, "Really?" They're like, "It's so fresh. It's so free. It's so imaginative." It's the whole idea. That kid didn't know what they were doing, right? But what you do is you take that freedom and then you sort of like, these are the two things that happen in what's going to happen in the world. It gets formalized so much that creativity gets stifled.
Stifled, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The other side is that you get taught, you don't get formalized, you just get taught how to be the best at what you can. Be the best you can be with the tools you have.
Mm.
So you take that kid who can mess up a room and you teach them how to decide to do that. Because when they did that, they were just doing it. But now what you got to give an artist is you take that childlike ability to create from a raw place and say, now do that consciously. And that is basically what the mastery of art is. The same freedom, and this is what the whole thing of Picasso and Matisse was. It was like, we need to be able to have our childlike freedom, but be able to tap into it whenever we want. So when you freestyle rap, right, if you do freestyle, like, you're freestyle rapping, you're basically needing to have the freedom of a child, but you need to be able to decide, you need to be able to decide within that freedom to be sick at rapping, if that makes sense to you. You get me?
Flow state.
You have to be in flow state. And what is required for that is mastery of challenge and complete and utter freedom of approach.
So it's being a serious play.
It's that. But you need the skills. So, like, for example, yeah, like, you see football, for example, like, my favourite footballers, for people like Zidane and Henry, they feel, what makes them amazing, bro, is that they are highly skilled because they've learned how to make the right decisions. But they play with all the flair and freedom of the enjoyment they had when they were younger. So, like, they first gained that love of football when they were kids, right? Playing on the Le Bonlieu, yeah? Which is the French ghettos, yeah? Some French person's going to say, it's not the ghetto. All right, cool. The French ends, the suburbs of Paris, right? But they sort of are just the ghettos. I'm not going to lie to you. But, yeah, it is what it is, yeah? They gained their ability to play there. And that's where they learned how to, like, be skillful and how to take on a man, you get me? And like how to get past people, blah, blah, blah. But then they now get picked up by academies, football academies, and they get taught how to be purposeful with what they know.
Broken down, rebuilt kind of thing.
They get taught how to be purposeful with it. And then when they become top levels, they play with freedom. Because when you develop the capacity,
so sick.
When you develop that skill and the purposefulness, you don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
If my boy freestyle raps, if I get on the piano and play some jazz piano, I'm not thinking, I want to do a seventh chord now, then do a ninth chord and then bring it back.
That's ultimate art.
I've learned it. I just ultimate. Do it now.
Yeah.
So I'm playing with the same freedom I had as a kid, right?
Mm.
But I've got skill now, but I don't have to think about the skill when I'm doing it because I've already learned it. That is really what great art is. So, you know what I'm saying? That's it. It comes down to that. From freestyle to, you know, to gymnasts, people like Simone Biles, to tennis players. When you get on, you're not in your head going, I've got, like, you know, a great footballer doesn't, when they're playing, think, I'm going to do three step overs and go past that man. Then I want to do a Cruyff turn around this defender and then I want to put an across to him because if I put, you don't think like that. You just play. A great freestyler doesn't in their head whilst freestyling go, if I say teeth, then I can rhyme that with beef.
No.
I can then bring that round and bring the word seed in and I can do an internal rhyme. You don't say that to yourself.
They're
you
might just do that doing
when you're writing.
It.
Might. I don't know what everybody's writing process is, but when you're freestyling, as you said, you're just doing it. You've learnt the ability to rap over the years of doing it. You enjoy it with the freedom of a kid, but you've got the freedom and the creativity of a child paired with purposeful understanding of an adult, and then you do it and it comes out so much better. You know what I'm saying? So like that's what I'm getting at. Like, you know, you need that to you as an artist. It's important.
Jazz jams. My mind is fucking blown.
You need that, fam.
My last subject in relation to this, before we sign off, of course, is as an actor, all of this can, in consideration, I'm thinking, you know, you're Jack Nichols. No, those sorts of people.
Nicholson,
it seems
favorite.
To me, yeah, bro, like, it seems to me like, A, they don't age like you describe, but also because acting is a, it's not seasonal. It's like you can be super old and there's still a role for you. In that respect, keeping that childlike approach in acting more than anything, because, you know, you don't break a bone or get arthritis in acting. That's a role as well. You've just got to keep a youthful spin on things, haven't you?
Yeah, man. I just think you always need that capacity to go back to that place of childlike freedom. When I did the Guy Ritchie film, I think with a great example, I had to do a shootout scene. Where do you think I went to for that shootout scene? Like, bro, hear this, yeah? Yo, Shenzi, hear this. I had to do this shootout scene in the Guy Ritchie film, yeah? In real life, I've never done a shootout, right? I've never ever had a shootout with somebody. People have and I haven't. So when I had to now do that shootout scene on the Guy Ritchie film, I couldn't go back in my head to a place where I've done shootout scenes. I wasn't thinking of, I couldn't reference it because I've never done it. So what do you think I went back to? I went back to playing shooting guns in my room with my brother. I said to myself, you know what? I used to play guns.
That's all I got, man.
That's it. That's all I had. I said to myself, I used to play shootout things in my room with my brother. So just go back to being a kid. And then I went on set and you just do it. I've never done a gun shootout, but where did I have to go to a childlike place to do the scene? Because really, that's where, think of the emotion of anger. When a person in real life is angry, they're in a shootout, that's the same anger you felt as a child.
And everything, yeah.
But it's just adult. Emotion is emotion. So even when you're playing, you got to, you know, I do it all the time. So when we talk about this thing of keeping youthful, bro, it is, you know, something they always talk about in acting is the importance of having a sense of play, right?
Yeah.
And it's so funny when I think about that because it's so easy to lose sight of that when you get too in your head. That sense of play is crucial. Like, if you think, that I'm not going to name people, but there are certain rappers, for example, that are amazing rappers, but maybe someone doesn't like listen to them and it's because they sound too serious. There are other rappers who also sound serious, but for some reason have this playfulness about them. Their lyrical topic is just as serious. Their content is just as serious. For example, right? Jesus Walks by Kanye West. That's a serious topic as far as I'm concerned. But why does he have that sense of play and the lyricism? All Falls Down. Tell Me That Ain't Insecure. The Concept of School. See, he's having fun though. But it's not a fun topic, is it?
No.
It's not a fun topic. If you read that, that's not. I could write an academic essay on the topic of All Falls Down. Yet, in the song, he's having fun. Do you know what it is? It's called a sense of play. It's a sense of play. It's the same thing that enables Jack Nicholson to be able to do One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, a film about a man who is pretending to be psycho and then, oh, I shouldn't have used that word, who's pretending to be deranged, right? In order to be in a psychiatric ward because he doesn't want to have to face prison. But then in the pretending to be deranged, the line starts to blur, right? Could he have played that character without having a sense of play about him? Yeah.
No.
You need a sense of play. It is crucial. It's what makes, it's the difference, right, between watching reality TV and watching a film. When you watch a film, right, the actors have to portray something like real life, but it can't be the same as real life because sometimes real life is flat. It's flat, right? But an actor, you're having a sense of play. So when you get on set, you don't just go, in real life, bro, like I've had moments in real life where somebody's chatting to me and I answer very lethargically and nobody goes, oh, that wasn't enough energy. They just accept what I do. So they might say to me, do you want a tea? Oh, no, I'm all right, thanks. So I might just be on my phone. What'd you say, man? Do you want a tea? Oh, I'm good, bro, I'm good. But if I'm on set, if I'm on stage, I can't say it like that. I'm good, man, I'm good. I've got to do it like that. There's got to be a little air behind it. That there is the sense of play.
Oh.
You lift it a little bit. It's not the same as flat reality.
Sense of play needs to just... I know what you mean about there's a time and a place, for sure. But the more sense of play you install into your day-to-day life, the more easier it is to switch on.
It is, man. I think it's something that children have. You get me? Like, my son, for example, that like, every second that like, you could leave him alone and he's got a whole monologue going. Like, he would be literally...
playing.
It's weird, bro, how they do it. Like, the other day, for example, he was washing his hands. But then he didn't come out of the bathroom straight away. And you know what he was doing? He was playing with the water. And I heard him saying to himself, the water's out of the tap. Oh, my hand. Hello, water. Nice to meet you. Blah, blah, blah. Splash, splash. They just keep talking to themselves. He's mad.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
You get me, bro? Yeah, I talk to myself at home as well. You get me? And a lot of people do, by the way. You get me?
Hold tight. They're talking to themselves. You know them ones. Come on.
And that is there. That is a playfulness, bro. Yeah. It's having a constant playfulness. But I was saying to my brother the other day, who's obviously my son's uncle, and he's just chatting to himself. I said, you know what they are, yeah? He is speaking every one of their thoughts. I got a video of on my phone of my son, yeah? Where he's sitting down, he's looking out the window, and he goes, oh, there's grandma. There's grandma. He goes, grandma's over there. And he looks at me, and he goes, 1, 2, button your shoe. 3, 4. Now, you see, in real life, that's us as adults. That's me looking up at the train signal. And I wouldn't say this aloud. I'll say it all in my head. 5 minutes. Imagine I'm speaking in my head. Oh, 5 minutes to the train. Flipping out, man. That's long. I should look quite a bit earlier, man. And then I'm silent for a bit. And then I see that girl. She looked quite nice.
Birds
that's
and fuzzy
how
things.
The human head is. But then the thing is, kids do that all out loud. There's grandma. There's grandma. 1, 2, butter match. They all say it out. Because they haven't gained that filter. Sometimes in psychology, they call this the shadow self. In philosophy, they call this the shadow self. The shadow self lives on the outside when you're a child. When we grow up, we put it back in our... We learn to sort of be normal. Now, what you see with people, for example, that are like, you know, suffering from certain drug addictions is that their shadow self becomes public again. So they speak. Like, you see when
that's
you
why
see...
a lot of people that get really creative are normally, or at least...
That's it.
They like the drug.
That's it, bro. And even just like... Creative people just seeming a bit weirder than everybody else.
Yeah. Do you get bohemian.
Like, bohemian, like you when they talk about the line between genius and crazy, well, really, it's just the line between filtering and not filtering.
Did you know there's some people out there watching this right now that are probably thinking exactly that about us on the way we're doing?
Oh, yeah, man.
Because this is a a luxury to be conversating in this.
It is, bro.
You know what I mean?
And, bro, like, let me just get this very straight, yeah? We know we're not the same as everybody else. You know, nobody's the same as anyone else. But the point is, us creators particularly, we're not a special breed. We're not more important than everybody. We're not a mutant breed. But we are almost like, you can see why so much of the country has a problem with us. Because it's like how dare you guys think you can just go in studios and make songs? How dare you get on stage and just pretend? Like, you know, when the government don't want to put funding into the arts, there is a sense of like, well, we all work hard. We all bring a service to the country. Who do you lot think you are playing for the rest of your lives? That's what we do. We have to remain playful to do what we do. And when we lose our playfulness, a lot of the sort of, you know, when you like, if you think of what it is, all artists have that moment where they take things too seriously and you start to lose confidence. The most enjoyable times in your career are the times when you're feeling the happiest, right? That's when you're most playful and that's when you're most free.
It's when you get the best footballers. It's when you get the... And let's remind ourselves, yeah, you're right. There is a... Maybe the suggestion for people that don't understand that creative process is that we have some sort of self-entitlement to want cash flow injected into something that we feel strongly about because it's at the brink of falling apart because of a lockdown. You know, the truth be told is this is an economy that is a tourist capture as much as a livelihood. It's like without the footballers, without the theatres, without the club night, without Fabric, that's a tourist spot. Whether you like it or not. Yeah, I mean, Carnival is a tourist attraction.
It is, bro.
You know what I mean? Glastonbury is a tourist attraction.
And what is it that makes Carnival so fun, by the way, bro? It's so charged. It takes us
lawless
back to
a youthful
and fun. State.
Yeah.
That's it. That's why people love concerts as well and moshing.
It's all lawless.
You see moshing out, yeah? And you see so many situations where humans become lawless. You just go to Wembley, the World Cup final.
Yeah.
Bro, do you see the amount of people that rush through the gates? Bro, and the fences. Bro, I sometimes see videos of football firm members, fighting. And like the other day, there was one on YouTube and I was just watching it, bro. And as you do, I had an existential moment when I was watching it. I said to myself, he woke up this morning and just brushed his teeth. Then he had a normal breakfast. And then 4 hours later, he was on the street throwing chairs about. I'm fighting with somebody. After a bit of alcohol. Bro, why do people love to drink? Why? Why? Oh, no, I want to, you know, get loose, tipsy. Why do people sometimes want to smoke weed? It is, but what it is, bro, is the escape of the blocking off of our shadow self. It's the escape of adultness. You know, it's the escape. Look at your family. Oh man, adulting is so hard. People say this a lot. We drink, we party, we rave, we smoke weed because essentially, bro, anybody who out there that disagrees, feel free to disagree, but I still think what I'm saying is correct. Essentially, it is to get to a state of child, of the same freedom child as state. A child. That's it. It's to let loose, it's to be free again. This is what music... That's it, fam. Leave inhibitions behind. We lower the inhibition. This is why we love
child
music, by
state.
The way. Get
yeah.
me? Funky house, that genre that took over. Everybody was having a fun time to it. They loved it because it made you... You lowered your inhibitions. Mm. When you're all skanking and being silly, you're not taking yourself seriously.
Nah.
You're just enjoying yourself.
Shit's got too serious, isn't it, in the arts?
And by the way, bro, just to like bring this point, that's part of the reason why so many of the country votes Boris Johnson. I'm not a Boris Johnson fan. I don't think anybody... Many people are, like, people in our world aren't. But why do you think so much of the old people that vote for him, vote for him? Bro, it's because he doesn't take himself seriously, you know?
Doesn't take They're himself drawn to how seriously.
Playful. People are drawn to how playful he is. That thing he has about him, all that energy he has, bro, people like it because it's like a jester. So you know what it is, yeah? Old people at home, normal, middle-aged people, they watch him and they think, yeah, you know what? He's not just some serious old git. He's having a laugh. Yeah. A lot of them thought Jeremy Corbyn was too serious. No, he's boring. Look at him, like, you know, he stands there like a bloody geography teacher.
Yeah.
That's what they think to themselves.
Yeah.
So I've heard Cockneys, yeah, talk down on Jeremy Corbyn, but speak up. Because you see Boris Johnson, not a fan, he can step into a pub with a bunch of blokes. Hey, yo, chaps, how are you doing? Yeah. And how are you doing, Boris? You all right, mate? And they will actually all be blokey together, even though... The world he's from is nothing like them,
yes,
bro. They won't vote Corbyn, even though he's from a lower income background, but they'll vote for... They won't vote Starmer, who grew up in some sort of...
Personality.
As well. But you see Johnson, he can sit... He's as posh as they come. He's related to, like, every royal family in Europe, bro. But let me tell you something, yeah? He can get in the pub, roll his sleeves up, and he can go, yo, an old chap, how are you doing? And Boris, there he is, the geezer. And they're all together on that, bro, because they're all being youthful, he's being youthful, and they've got a finger, you get me? I don't respect the man. I don't like him, but I'm trying to tell you that part of the appeal he has is that he's like, he allows people to relax. He allows, you see, when he was the London mayor, everybody said, what? He brought a sense of fun. The London mayor before him was Ken Livingstone, yeah? Very serious, you know, and Britain, London will be on top. Whereas Boris Johnson, London, it makes people, you know what I mean?
It comes
with a character. Now, once
of endearment.
Again,
and
that's it, bro. And I just need to really say for people, I am not a Conservative voter. I'm not a Tory fan. I'm not a Boris Johnson fan. What we're speaking about here is the nature of persona and how it affects the way people perceive things.
Crazy. That's crazy.
It. You get me? So, yeah. That's it.
And where? How do I carry on my day with this? Now I'm thinking to myself, oh, I'm going to start the week. What the hell's going on? Is
the
he like this all the time,
Chemsy?
Is this 24-7? What you're getting here, people, is a snapshot into the life and times of gentlemen. Bro, like, that's crazy.
The last thing I want to say, bro, by the way, it's also the reason why a man like Simon Cowell are not popular. You know? You see, kids, do you want that? No. Simon Cowell, I didn't like your singing. He's blunt like a kid. You see what I'm trying to say?
Good example.
Piers Morgan.
Piers Morgan,
see these
same.
People on television.
Jeremy Kyle, blah, blah, blah.
Gordon Brown. Gordon Ramsay. You're cooking his shit. He's throwing a tantrum like an 8-year-old. Simon Cowell is as blunt as a 3-year-old being asked, do you want rice? My son, right? Do you want rice? No. You know, no. An adult walks into a room, so you want rice. In your head, you're thinking, I'm not even really that hungry. But what do you say in real life? Yeah, thanks, that'd be really nice, because you don't want to offend, right? Children have no fear of that. This is the reason why people like Nasty Nigel from Pop Idol back in the day, Simon Cowell, people like flipping Gordon Ramsay, they go deep that, like, even the evil one on Strictly Come Dancing, Craig Revel Horwood, they grow popular because they are blunt, and it's this concept of they say what nobody else is prepared to. Piers Morgan, you know, when he sits there and he goes at a trans person, because there's a bunch of people in their house who are thinking what they think. Once again, I'm not aligning my views with Piers Morgan, but I'm trying to say that these people become popular because they are blunt.
Yeah.
And kids are blunt. You see what I mean? People are constantly drawn to those who represent a childish freedom that they can't embody. So that's how I'm going to finish.
Bro.
Yeah.
My guy. I guess the moral of the story is be you. Be playful.
Be playful, but don't be like Boris Johnson and Piers Morgan.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't be a prick about it. You get me? But yeah, be you. You know what, bro? I think ultimately, bro, yeah. Being you is important, but I think, and I've got to say this, it's important to not throw your weight about. I'll say it like that. I think part of an adult is that you accept that you're not a kid anymore. You don't have that right to throw your weight like a kid because the world does not have to accommodate you. Part of being an adult is understanding how to exist in tandem with other people. Kids don't have to do that because their world is created for them. My son has no idea how he eats. He has no idea where his clothes come from. He has no idea why he... I decide his... Me and his mom decide his purpose of his days for him. As an adult, you got to decide that. And part of deciding purpose is deciding to live purposefully without constantly coming into problems. And this is why we do develop that filter, because you've got to learn how to be civilized, essentially. But within that, don't lose the joy of living. That's how I think the moral is. Don't lose the joy of living. Good energy, bro. I think all what we're saying down to, it just comes down to this. Have good energy.
100%.
You get me? I feel like that is definitely how we could close it. Just have good energy.
Good energy.
That's it, bro.
Always good energy having you in, my brother. Pleasure,
man. I'm glad we touched on the craft.
Yeah.
Touched on life.
Because we didn't do that on the last one, did we?
So it was good to touch on the craft.
Yeah, it was good. And this, as a... I mean, look, feel free to go and check out the other podcast, Go For Your Life. But I'm saying, definitively, my brother's come through. Alessandro Babalola.
My guy. Yeah, man.
Good friend of
Always
mine.
Always a pleasure, my
love. Yeah, man, for real. See, what'd that tell you? Even the flies jumping in involved. See what I'm saying? You know, we do it every week, giving it to you raw, uncut, Killer Killer Podcast. Hey, tell a friend, sharing is caring, all right? Yeah. Don't talk to anyone. I wouldn't, for God's sake, all right? You stay lucky, people. Cheers, Al.
My guy. Always a pleasure, yeah? Love.
Stay lucky, people. Peace. What the dog and... Cheers!
That was sick.
Yo, that was another one.
So impressed.
And another one.
Really good. Wow. I've never actually heard him just speak like that.